September 27th, 2025, Abhayagiri Monastery, coming to the end of our Vasa period very quickly. So on October 7th, it'll be Pavarana Day. October 12th, Katina. It's all approaching very quickly. And thought could start the talk this evening with perhaps a thought experiment and just to see what this does to your mind. And so try to think of if you were given one wish, you were given one wish, and that wish would certainly come true, what would it be? Think about it. And it can only be one wish. It can't be like, I wish and dot, dot, dot. You know, there's no and, so there can't be an and. What would your one wish be? As a practitioner, what would you wish for? The monastics can try to think of this as well. What would you wish for? I found this to be incredibly difficult. So if you were able to come up with a wish, then you can ask yourself, did you wish for something temporary or did you wish for something lasting? So in 2023, I was in Malaysia and just by chance, I got the opportunity. This was June 2023. Got the opportunity to do a video chat with Lungpa Rawpat at the time, I was preparing to go to Burma to practice at Shwedagon Pagoda for 2 weeks and was invited by Ajahn Acharlo. And so it was quite fortuitous that I got to speak with Lungpa Rawpat over video because he is Burmese. And so I told him I was going to go to Shwedagon Pagoda and practice. And he said, oh, good, 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 good. And I asked him if he had any advice for practicing there. And he said, go to the northeast corner of the chedi and there take 3 white candles with you, 3 sticks of incense, bow 3 times, and make a wish. Whatever your wish is there, it will come true. So then when I actually went and I had my candles and my incense and I was daily basis offering candles and incense and bowing and meditating, but I couldn't figure out what to wish for. If I knew my wish was going to come true, what would I wish for? I wouldn't want to wish for something temporary, or I'd want to wish for something that was beneficial, of benefit to myself and others, but I couldn't figure out exactly what to wish for. So just kind of held that thought with an open mind and just each day offering candles and incense, bowing. And I figured out he was giving me Burmese inside knowledge, and the Burmese lay people knew about that spot. It's called Rahu Corner. And in Thai, Rahu is an Asura, a demigod who is responsible for eating the sun and causing solar eclipses. So when a solar eclipse occurs, it's because Rahu eats the sun, but then everybody spreads merit and all their good wishes, and then he has to spit it back out. Or you could think that it kind of burns through his body. He can't handle it, and then the sun has to reappear. It has to come out again. So Rahu is the one who eats the sun, but that's not who Rahu is in Burma. Rahu is a different entity in Burma. Rahu is the lord of death. So it's you're actually making aspirations and offerings to the Lord of Death. So Rahu in Burma is like a Mara type figure, or Yama, you could say King Yama, the one who tallies up the good and bad karma or the accounts, the one you have to see and receive your verdict from after death. So Rahu is that type of character. So I found that to be a profound practice, actually, making offerings to Rahu Corner. And by the end of the trip, I thought, well, I made these offerings, need to kind of wish for something. So it's kind of second to last day. It was coming into the rainy season, so this was late June, early July. And the Shwedagon Pagoda is the, I believe it's the biggest stupa in the world, the biggest chedi in the world. And because of its proportions, it kind of doesn't look like that, but it's actually exactly twice the height of the Mahabodhi Stupa. So the Mahabodhi Stupa, if for anybody who's been there, is quite tall. There's a little image of it on the shrine here next to our relics of great disciples. And that's 55 meters tall. So for anybody who can multiply 55 times 3.8, that's how many feet that is. So 175 or 180 feet or something like that. 55 meters is the height of the Mahabodhi Stupa. And Shwedagon Pagoda is exactly twice that. It's 110 meters tall. So 400 feet or something like that. And covered in sheets of gold from top to bottom. Sheets of pure gold. And said to contain the relics of the four Buddhas of this aeon who have come and gone already. That's Kakusanda Buddha, Kona Gamana Buddha, Kassapa Buddha, and Gotama Buddha. And another cool thing about Shwedagon Pagoda is that it's said that it was originally built while the Buddha was still alive, because after the Buddha's awakening, when he was in the vicinity of the Bodhi tree for 7 weeks, absorbed in various postures and places, absorbed in the bliss of deliverance, bliss of liberation, then at the end of the 7th week, while sitting at the Rajayatana tree, then the merchants Tapusa and Balika were taken by the presence of the Buddha and wanted to offer a meal. And so that was said to be the first meal that the Buddha took after the awakening. It was offered by these merchants, Tapusa and Balika, and then in thanks or in anumodana, the Buddha took 8 of his hairs and gave them to these merchants. And those merchants took those hairs back to their homeland and offered them to their king. And that homeland is said to be present-day Burma, and those 8 hairs are said to be the beginnings of Shwedagon Pagoda. And the story behind that is this king asked one of his seers to divine the best location to enshrine these hairs of these newly awakened Buddha that has appeared in the world. And the seer came up with this spot on a hill, on a mound. There was already a mound there to build a small pagoda, which was perhaps I believe it was 27, 28 feet tall. It was the first monument that was built there. But then when that monument was built to enshrine these 8 hairs of the newly awakened Buddha, then a cave complex was discovered underneath. So this mound was actually a complex of caves. And as the legend goes, they discovered that previous chedis had been built there in previous Buddhist eras, and that there was relics of Kakusanda, Konagamana, Kassapa Buddha there as well. And so when you circumambulate this chedi, then there's Buddha images, salas, shrines dedicated to these four Buddhas. So it was coming to the end of our trip, and I didn't really know what to wish for. And I had a few more white candles with me to offer up. They have places to light candles. And in the meantime, Ajahn Acalo had decided to go big and do an offering of 5,000 butter lamps all around the chedi as well. We were lighting butter lamps, and I had my 3 white candles left, and I had 60 sticks of incense left. So I had this kind of Nag Champa, very fragrant incense. Thought, well, okay, I've got to use up my incense and my candles, so I'm going to make another offering, but I'll light all of these incenses. And it was kind of drizzling rain a little bit. It was a little bit hard to light the incense, but I got it lit, all 60 sticks, and there's kind of a flame coming off the top, and I offered that to the chedi, and I thought, okay, now I need to make my wish. And so I thought, okay, I finally come up with a wish I can make. And so I bowed, made my wish, and then there was this flame coming off the incense, and I was kind of got up, and I was kind of trying to like bat out this flame and blow it out so that the incense could just do its thing. But the flame wasn't going out, and then a wind came up, and then the incense just turned into a big fireball, and then it just incinerated in a few seconds, and then it was just a pile of ash. And the man who was helping look after us, he's Chinese Thai. He said, "Oh, Ajahn, what did you wish for in China? That would be very powerful, very powerful." So now you probably want to know what I wished for. So I just, my wish was, it was just around practice. May I never be overpowered by the defilements. May I always find myself in situations, or may situations always be presented to me that I'm always able to deal with the defilements. May I overpower them. May they not overpower me. So just a wish around practice, around continuity of practice, trying to keep the practice going long-term, just to not be overpowered by the defilements. And that's really all I could come up with, because wishing for something material, I wish we could get new land around the monastery, and or I wish we could get a better monastery vehicle, or, it just seemed really lame. I wish my back would stop hurting. I wish all wars would end, but even, or I wish everybody would get along with each other. I wish that person would stop annoying me. I wish that person would stop chewing, so the person sitting next to me would stop chewing their potato chips so loudly. Those kind of wishes we make on a daily basis. But it's funny when you think about it. And it's just human nature to think like this. We're making wishes all the time. I wish these people would get along with each other. If we wish that somebody stops irritating and annoying us, that sometimes it's good to just verbalize what's actually happening in the mind. I want this person to act differently so that I can be happy. I want this person to stop being who they are so that I can feel better. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. We're doing it all the time. One thing I like to keep coming back to is the Buddha's just laying the teachings out there for us, that he's not ever judging anybody. He's just laying it out there. If you want to stop suffering, this is what you do. If you want to keep suffering, this other thing is what you do. And it's up to you. Whatever you do is up to you. You are fully empowered to either stop suffering or keep suffering. But if you want to stop suffering, it's going to take work and it's going to take effort. And we can think of some of these eight qualities of Dhamma Vinaya that the Buddha taught to Maha Pajapati Gotami Bhikkhuni when she came to him seeking instruction in order to dive further into her practice. And if you know of certain qualities and practices, these things lead to dispassion, not to passion, lead to seeking seclusion, not to seeking engagement, lead to modesty, not to accumulation, lead to energy, not to laziness, lead to being unburdensome, not to being burdensome, and so on. Those are just a few of them. Lead to contentment, not to discontent, lead to being humble, not to lifting oneself up, not to self-aggrandizement. Of these, you can be sure, if whatever you're doing is leading to those things, that is the Dhamma, that is the Vinaya, that is the Dhamma, that is the discipline. It's possible this teaching was given before the Vinaya rules were formulated. So Dhamma Vinaya, there was an understanding of that you act in a certain way that leads to those qualities. And you can be sure, there can be no doubt, that this is definitely the Dhamma, this is the Vinaya, this is the master's teaching. I think just taking qualities like that can be incredibly useful for our practice. Anytime we feel that the passions are increasing and not decreasing, what are we doing to cause that to happen? What are we focusing on? How are we using our attention? How are we directing our attention? If something like anger and irritation, frustration is increasing and not decreasing, how are we using our attention? What are we focusing on to cause that? It's like this bumper sticker that Ajahn Amaru was talking about that he saw in the Bay Area. If you aren't angry, you aren't paying attention. And his response was, if you're angry, you're paying attention in the wrong way. So the way we use our attention, this is yoni so manasikara. This is wise attention, skillful attention. If the passions are increasing and we want to practice, we want the cool mind. We want the mind to cool off. We want the mind to be peaceful. But if the passions are increasing, that's hot and burning. And how can we focus in a way to cool that off? So we have these reflections, contemplations of asubha kamatana, the reflection on one's own body as not beautiful, not alluring, not attractive. And the what we call the mula kamatana, or the root meditation objects that we teach to novices that they're going forth, is hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. Those are the five things that are visible on a human body. And so this isn't just to overlay something on reality, but it's not an overlayment. It's just the truth of the way things are. It's the way it is, and we use it for reflection. And it's also not to, say, end our relationships with people. Say, for lay people, we don't want to reflect on these things in order to end our relationships. We reflect on these things just to cool the heart down. If there's too much passion, sometimes it gets out of balance, and to cool the heart down. But it's not just for that. It's also for reflecting on not self. Or we can reflect on the elements, or we can do things like death contemplation, charnel ground contemplation, the different stages of decomposition of a corpse. These are all part of mindfulness of the body, all these reflections. Or else one just knows there is a body. In the suttas, it says that how does an arhant view the body? The arhant views the body as feeble. So the arhant sees the body as feeble. No matter how strong our body is, no matter how healthy our body is, the arhant sees the body as feeble. And so whatever's happening in the body, it can become the whole world. It can become overpowering. If we have some sort of pain in the body, especially strong pain, it can be completely overpowering for the mind. And yet the arhant sees the body as feeble. So the body's feeble because it falls apart. It's easy to break it. Yeah, we can fall and hit our head, and the head can break quite easily. If we're not careful, we can sprain our wrist, or we can twist our knee, or we can eat something that disagrees with us, and we can get sick. All these things. We can develop diseases like cancer and so on. The causes of death are many. Causes of life are few. And so it just breaks up. It's feeble. That's just the way it is. And we reflect on it that way, not to become despondent or melancholy, but to gain a sense of the mind rising above these conditions. So to cool the mind down, if there's a sense of passion, a sense of attachment, then to cool the mind down, we can reflect on these things. Or we can put the heat somewhere else. So Dhamma Raga, this term Dhamma Raga, is a passion for the Dhamma. We can focus on the Dhamma in a way that we can get inspired and the heat can go somewhere else. So the heart can be uplifted. And when we gain joy connected with the Dhamma, then we might experience that as a burning in the heart center, or a sense of excitement, deep contentment, sense of deep conviction in the Dhamma. So that's Dhamma Piti. So if we have this really strong fire for the Dhamma, passion for the Dhamma, we can take that heat, we can put it somewhere else. Something like laziness and energy. You can think, okay, you know, just kind of time to take it easy. And sometimes the energy is too much. Sometimes it's out of balance. The energy can be too frenetic, and I personally know how that is. So we do have to cool it off. But then sometimes it goes too far in the kind of inertness, laziness, just kind of getting bored, not knowing what to do with ourselves. At that time, we can give rise to a sense of energy. And that can happen through just giving rise to a sense of energy. We just do it. If the mind is feeling low and sluggish, we can take some deep breaths, straighten our posture, just do things that are going to give rise to a sense of energy, do some walking meditation. Sometimes these things, there's not really a method or technique other than just doing it. Just how do we get ourselves to do it? We can reflect on the Buddha's example We can reflect on the Dhamma. We can try to encourage and inspire ourselves, give rise to a sense of energy. Sometimes it's going to be natural that we're feeling low, feeling under the weather, the mind. Sometimes there's karmic obstacles that can arise. We feel tired, feel fed up, feel that we're stuck in a rut. So it's these times when we need to really give rise to a sense of energy, or we wake up in the morning, we don't want to get up. We want to hit the snooze button. So it's at that time that we have to come up with some sort of skillful means. I heard of a monk in the past who would put a glass of water in his toothbrush and toothpaste next to him, and as soon as his alarm went off, he would shove his toothbrush into his mouth. Or like Tenzin Gyatso getting up and chanting the Metta Sutta really loud when he got up, just bringing up that energy. So we all have to find these upaya, these skillful means for bringing up energy. Being unburdensome, not being burdensome. Are we doing things that burden others? Even if it's talking to somebody and we don't really detect that maybe they want to get back to their kuti, or engaging with somebody and it's really because we want somebody to pay attention to us and we're kind of taking that away from somebody. We're taking somebody's time when really we could actually be burdening somebody by doing that. Or are we doing things that are inadvertently causing burdens for others? So finding the right time, this is knowing the kala desa, the time and place, knowing the right situation, the right time for things, knowing how to decrease the burdens of others rather than increase them. And that's fine if we're willing to take a burden on for ourselves. And then just finding ways to help out, finding ways to decrease somebody else's burden. And even if it's something like holding a grudge against somebody, that's a burden. That's a burden for us and it's a burden for somebody else. So we have to have a bayadana, a sense of forgiveness, no matter what it is. And the sense of forgiveness, that's another thing where you just do it. If you're waiting to find a reason to forgive somebody, you're not going to find it, because a lot of the time it's not logical. So we just have to see that it's suffering to not forgive. It's suffering to hold grudges. It's suffering to hold on to negativity. So it's in our best interest, and it is in the best interest of others to forgive, to be a very forgiving person. It doesn't mean we're condoning another's bad actions. It just means we're acknowledging that not forgiving causes suffering. To hold a grudge doesn't help. Seeking seclusion, not seeking engagement. This is, seclusion is an acquired taste, and it's something that we need to train ourselves in. It doesn't just happen automatically. Some people who have the right parami, they might naturally feel affinity with seclusion. But normally we need to train ourselves in it and acquire a taste for it. And once we acquire a taste for seclusion, then we won't feel bored, we won't feel lonely. I think I spent so much time at Pujam Gom up in the caves there, and I never felt lonely. I felt lonely plenty of times in big groups of people, but I never felt lonely up in the national park, up in solitude, far away from the village. So what is loneliness? Loneliness is that lack of connection, that sense of alienation we might feel. It's not really dependent on being around others or not being around others. So in solitude, we learn how to connect with ourselves. If we can connect with ourselves, that's metta for oneself. If we're just kind of forcing ourselves in solitude, forcing ourselves to meditate, we're not really gaining that connection with ourselves, that metta connection, metta for oneself. It's unsustainable. There's one sutta where a monk asks the Buddha, I think it's in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Bhikkhu Samyutta, where monks come, no-name bhikkhus come and ask the Buddha questions. And a bhikkhu asks the Buddha, why is it here that some monks disrobe? And why is it here that some monks stay? And the Buddha says, it's here that some monks disrobe because they gave inappropriate attention to the sign of the beautiful. And it's here that some monks stay, that they gave appropriate attention to the sign of the unbeautiful. And it's here that some monks leave because they give inappropriate attention to the sign of the unbeautiful, and it's here some monks stay because they give appropriate attention to the sign of the beautiful. So inappropriate attention to the sign of the beautiful, that's lust. Appropriate attention to the sign of the unbeautiful, that's the recollection of the unattractive or unbeautiful nature of the body. Inappropriate attention to the sign of the unbeautiful. Let's see if you can memorize this. Inappropriate attention to the sign of the unbeautiful is when we focus on faults of somebody and give rise to anger. Appropriate attention to the sign of the beautiful is metta. So that's reflecting on good qualities and spreading goodwill. That's appropriate attention to the sign of the beautiful. So that sense of developing metta for ourselves, if we aren't able to do that, then it's only natural that we're going to seek it outside. We're going to seek it somewhere else. If we can't give it to ourselves, we're going to seek it from somebody or something else. So that's so important to develop that sense of metta for ourselves, because that's sustainable too. If we're seeking it from outside, maybe we'll receive it sometimes, maybe sometimes not. And if we're able to have it for ourselves, then there's always going to be that sense of connection, sense of fullness. So that looking at solitude versus engagement, that's Dhamma, that's Vinaya. So whatever we decide to wish for, then as practitioners, then it behooves us to wish for something that is going to be in line with Dhamma, in line with Vinaya, and that's going to be for our long-term and lasting welfare and benefit. I'll leave that for reflection this evening.